She inadvertently dumps gasoline all over herself, shoots a flare gun, and the boat explodes to high heaven. And it's just like, oh my God. That escalated very quickly. And then it gives the shark a scar. And then we have Scarface the shark, which is just a touch that I love with this movie. Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We are your hosts, Vincent Hannum
and Matt Levine.
And we are talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here.
Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes.
Jaws 2. The terror continues. In all the vast and unknown depths of the ocean, how could there have been only one?
Chief Brody, can we go, please?
I think we may have another shark problem.
Are you serious?
Roy Scheider.
I ordered my dad!
The whole beast looks incredible.
Lorraine Gary. And Murray Hamilton.
Look at this. That's a shark.
You started a panic on a public beach. Now, what if somebody decides to sue us? That's a shark. Did you ever stop to think about that?
And I know what a shark looks like because I've seen one up close. And you better do something about this one because I don't intend to go through that hell again.
Don't press it this time.
Mike is out there.
Man's fantasies of evil can compare with the reality of Jaws.
Here we are, second episode, Matt, season 5, part 2.
Yeah, good to be back.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Summer is nearing its end, but aside from that, I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm good. Also, in soaking up the last bit of summer here. Not like September is not often summer weather, but you know, something changes when the calendar flips to September.
Yeah, for sure. And I love fall, so I'm not necessarily complaining, but there's always something a little bit bittersweet about the end of summer. Maybe it's just like the nostalgia from being a kid, you know, but you got to hold on to those last days.
It's like so many movies. I'm thinking about Stand By Me. It's just all about, or The Sandlot. It's about youth in summer, and then it fades away like your own youth, and then you become a bitter old person in the winter, only to be reborn again in the youthful spring.
I'm glad you had that ending there because I was about to get very depressed, but then you turned it around. I like that. It's true. It's the cycle that we all go through. And not to remind you of this, but you, as you've mentioned on the podcast before, you're a teacher. So you're like wonderful summer off of just like watching 4 monster movies a day. That's what I assume you do during your summer. It's about to come to an end. So I'm sure that's bittersweet.
I can no longer fall asleep in my chair at midnight watching some B movie. I mean, I could, but I will pay for it the next day.
Yeah, yeah. You'll have to do it less often than usual.
Well, speaking of that, watching movies and old movies and new movies, what have you seen lately?
I've seen a lot of good stuff, although I don't know how many of them are monster movies per se, but I guess the first thing that comes to mind, I have to shout out Weapons. I loved it. So good. From the director of Barbarian, which I would say is a monster movie. I don't know if Weapons is exactly a monster movie, but it's a great horror movie. Very scary, very unpredictable and stylish. Really loved it. So if you haven't seen Weapons yet, check it out.
That's awesome. I haven't, but everyone's talking about it. I was impressed with Barbarian. So yeah, I'll check out Weapons. I saw that The Monkey is finally streaming on Hulu. I have not seen it yet, but I am very excited to finally watch that movie. I'm holding off on Sinners until October, but there's just like, I'm excited to watch some recent new horror films and finally check those off the list because the hype is good.
Yeah. I feel like we're in kind of a golden age of horror. There's a lot of good stuff out there. Sinners is great. I really like Together a lot, which is, I would say that's actually a monster movie, sort of unexpectedly. But it's also kind of a comedy, a very dark comedy, and a relationship drama at the same time. So I like Together quite a bit as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Final Destination Bloodlines, another horror movie that I want to see. Haven't gotten to yet.
That's a whole series that I would... You know, the appeal to me is there. I just have not, like, summoned up the, not the courage, but the willpower to watch any of those movies.
Yeah. I have a soft spot for them. I do like that series. I feel like those movies and the Fast and the Furious are kind of the same thing for me, where, you know, they fall into the guilty pleasure category. There are so many of them, and I, like, don't really love the assembly line nature of them. And yet at the same time, they're very fun, very entertaining, high concept, you know, just pop entertainment. And there's something very fun about those movies.
Well, that's a series that I think would do, it would serve me well to watch it with somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we can laugh and we can just roll our eyes together at what is happening.
I think you're right about that. And like maybe even like a packed theater full of people all like laughing at the same time, you know. Sadly, I didn't see Bloodlines in the theater, so I kind of missed my opportunity for that. But I've heard good things.
Yeah. Okay, cool. What have I watched recently? I watched Clash of the Titans. Have you ever seen that?
The original or the more recent one?
Both. I watched both of them, actually.
I guess I don't know why I asked, because I have not seen either of them.
Well, the first one from the 80s, Ray Harryhausen, special effects. Laurence Olivier plays Zeus. Maggie Smith is a goddess. There's a lot of entertaining things going on. And then in the remake, and it is a remake from 2010, starring Liam Neeson as Zeus.
Hmm.
And you get the memeified line, "Release the Kraken." And, you know, I gave it a solid 3 out of 5 stars. I expected so much worse, but actually it's a solid adventure fantasy picture.
They both sound kind of great. I want to see both of those. And I feel like some of those ancient Greek movies, right? Ancient Greek, or is that ancient Roman? That's Greek, right?
No, they're Greek. Yeah.
You know, like, there's a lot of guilty pleasure potential there as well. Like, even if they're bad, like, you have, you know, actors like Laurence Olivier, Liam Neeson, like, hamming it up the whole time. That's great. How can you not have fun watching that, you know? I'm assuming, anyway. I haven't seen it yet, but...
No, you're right. You don't even need to see it. You just... That's it.
Well, I still plan on seeing them someday. Who knows when? Yeah.
Good, good. All right, but tonight we are continuing our August Bites, August series. We're following up killer gorillas in the Congo with a killer shark in New England. That's right, Jaws 2, everybody. Maybe we should have led with that, but why would you be listening to this if you didn't know what it was? It's in the title, Jaws 2. This time it's just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water. That's it. That's
yeah. One of the most famous taglines of all time.
It is. Yeah. Whether or not, whatever you think about the movie, I think the legacy is there, and I'm excited to dig into this film. There's a lot of behind the scenes stuff to get into, some drama between actors and director and the producers. There's things going on with the shark. It's all, if you know the history behind the production of Spielberg's Jaws, a lot of that comes back into play as well, with like the mechanical shark and the ocean and whatnot. So celebrating Jaws's 50th anniversary, I said, let's do the sequel.
Which I love. And, you know, I do want to remind our listeners that we did talk about Jaws the Revenge also on the podcast, maybe like 2 years ago, something like that. Well, so I'm sure we'll talk about that movie as well, maybe even Jaws 3D a little bit later in this episode. Yeah, I won't get into too much detail about the sequels yet. They're hit or miss. I'll just say that at this point.
I love it. I'm so excited. Okay. Some nuts and bolts, though. We got to thank our listeners and all our friends of the pod for hanging out with us here. If you like what you're listening to, please rate and review. You send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com, Instagram at camp_kaiju_podcast. If you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, let us know what you think about the Jaws sequels. Our voicemail number is 612-470-2612. Check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, where you'll never miss any of our content. But if you really want to get the inside scoop on all things Camp Kaiju, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/campkaiju. And you can join the ranks of Jason, Beastrul, Chris B, Sean, our anonymous patron, and Peggy. And just like them, maybe we'll send you a magnet. Maybe we'll send you a sticker. Discounts on t-shirts. You know, I'm not complaining that you all don't hit us up for those discounts. But honestly, if you wanted a shirt, patrons, I will just send you a shirt. Really. You can't give them away. So please drop us a line. Let us know if you want a shirt or a pillowcase or anything with our logo on it. It's yours.
What a deal, man.
What a deal. So check out patreon.com if you haven't yet. Matt, I got to know. You mentioned during our Congo episode that you and your friends played a board game that you all created. Yeah. I wanted to hear more about that, and I feel like I just ran my mouth and didn't give you time. So please tell us about Congo, the board game.
Oh, well, first of all, I wouldn't say that. I feel like, you know, we're both running our mouths throughout the entire recording. I mean, that's kind of the name of the game, right? So it's, you know, it's cool. I didn't want to spend too much time on that board game, but it is awesome. My friend Chris made it. It's called The Lost City of Zinj, which of course is the name of the ancient city in Congo. And yeah, you play where you start off on the continent of Africa. You go from one city to another. You have to find resources to like prepare to go into the jungle. Much like in the movie, you have to pay off warlords. It's equally offensive in the board game as it is in the movie. I'll just say that. And then eventually you make it into the jungle. You have to like go past tiger traps. You do set up like the automatic sentry guns like they have in the movie as well. Like that's part of the board game. And then, yeah, you have to find the priceless diamonds in the lost city of Zinj and then make it back out alive. It's a lot of fun. Chris did a great job on that board game. So if he's listening, I told him to listen to the Congo episode. I don't know if he's going to or not. But thanks, Chris. Many hours of fun playing that game.
Wow. He should patent it. I would buy that.
Yeah, I don't know how much we would have to pay for the rights to Congo. Honestly, probably not very much at this point, but I could be wrong. Could be wrong about that.
The rights holders are like me with our Threadless Thor. They can't give away their intellectual property.
Yeah. Please rip off Congo for free is what Universal Studios is telling people right now. And still nobody's doing it.
I love a good monster movie themed board game. That's a conversation for another time. Mm-hmm. But let's get into this month in monster movie history. It's August. What do we got here? We have a whole bunch of titles. The Abyss. We have Prophecy. That's coming up later in our season. Suspiria I just watched, I'm going to shout out Jason and the Argonauts from 1963. Speaking of Ray Harryhausen, Greek mythology, motion pictures, Jason and the Argonauts is a lot of fun. It's an adventure fantasy film, but it is the film that features the iconic scene where a bunch of skeleton warriors come to life and attack, and Jason has to fend them off. So it's a great like sword battle, hand-to-hand combat scene, but Jason is fighting a small army of skeletons, and it's awesome. Just look it up on YouTube, everybody, if you haven't. Jason and the Argonauts.
I've always wanted to see that, and I feel like I really need to learn more about Ray Harryhausen. That's one of the blind spots in my cinematic education, and we've started to compensate for that here on the podcast. We talked about The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, but hopefully there will be more Harryhausen in the future because I need to see a lot more.
Well, you're bringing one such film to the show later this year.
Oh, yeah. 20 Million Miles to Earth, right?
Yeah.
Honestly, I forgot that was Ray Harryhausen. So it's like I planned this, but I didn't actually plan it. It's all just coming together.
Well, you're in for a nice surprise.
Can't wait, man. And Jason and the Argonauts sounds awesome. I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah, it's fun. All right. What do you want to shout out here?
I think I'm going to shout out the first movie on this list, which is The Ghost and the Darkness from 1996. For whatever reason, I think I've had an obsession maybe with 90s monster movies. We talked about Congo in the last episode. We also recently talked about The Relic, The Island of Dr. Moreau, some other movies from that time. And The Ghost in the Darkness came out when I was 12 years old. And I feel like it's one of those movies where once you get a little bit older, nowadays, you're like, oh yeah, that movie. I vaguely remember that. And as Val Kilmer, Michael Douglas, it's about killer lions. I feel like it actually would have been a good choice for August Bites. So we might have to keep that in mind for next year.
Yeah, yeah. I've never seen it, no. But when I was a kid, I learned about... They're called the man-eating lions of Tsavo. But basically in Africa around the early 1900s, the British were building a railway. And of course they hired a bunch of locals to build that railway. But the lions in the area actually got a taste for human flesh. And dozens of people were eaten and stolen out of their beds at night. And I learned about this when I was a kid, and I still have nightmares about it. Like, honestly, the man-eating lions of Tsavo.
Yeah, and that's what this movie is based on. It's set in Africa in the early 20th century, and it's exactly that story, basically.
Oh, my gosh.
I did see it when I was a kid. I remember it kind of traumatizing me when I was 12 or 13 years old whenever I saw it. I have no idea if it holds up or not, but I really want to rewatch it sometime soon. Mm.
Yeah, I'd be interested in seeing that. Nice. Well, speaking about new releases, we talked about Weapons, but there's a movie that came out in July, actually, that I never got around to shouting out, but it's called Dangerous Animals, and it's a survival horror film, but there are sharks in this movie. It was produced through Shudder, which just makes me want to get a Shudder subscription. But Dangerous Animals, from what I understand, is about a serial killer who takes people out on his boat, but he feeds them to the sharks. And I'm like, wow, that sounds campy and horrific, and I want to see it.
Yeah, totally. I love that premise. And that kind of came out of nowhere. I didn't really hear about that till recently, and it fits in perfectly with tonight's episode.
Yeah, Dangerous Animals. Shark genre, the shark genre in and of itself is surprisingly something I haven't watched a lot of. Like, I know Open Water is supposed to be pretty good, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But honestly, it looked too scary for me when it came out.
Yeah.
But something like Deep Blue Sea is exactly in my wheelhouse. Have you seen that movie?
Yeah, I love Deep Blue Sea. That's great. It has one of the best character deaths of all time, and that's all I'm going to say.
Ooh, it's been years since I've seen it. Because it used to be on TBS a lot, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is probably 20 years ago.
Right. Yeah. It might make the rounds again sometime, but that's a good cable movie for sure. Love Deep Blue Sea. I also really want to see The Shallows. I think Blake Lively is in that movie. Never seen that. That's another shark-themed movie, I think. The Meg, I would like to see. I've heard mixed things about that.
Oh, yeah. See that one for yourself. Unfortunately, you know, it is what it is, to each their own. It just wasn't my cup of tea, surprisingly. So, you know, sometimes I surprise myself where, you know, a movie like The Meg should be something that I love. And people are a little surprised to hear that I didn't love it.
I mean, just like seeing the trailers and everything, I don't assume it's actually very good, but I feel obligated to see it at some point.
Yeah, it's all spectacle, which, hey, if that's what you want, no harm, no foul.
Yeah. A lot of CGI, though, right? Which, as we've talked about many times, is not my cup of tea.
Right. Right. Your cup of chum.
Indeed. Nice. That was, I did not expect that. Well done. That was good. I sort of hope we never talk about the Sharknado movies on Camp Kaiju, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. Maybe somebody brings them to the pod someday, and then I'm going to have to eat my words. But yeah, let's hold off on that for a while, preferably. No Sharknado.
I'm not saying I'm bringing Sharknado anytime soon, but it has been in my back pocket for a while.
Yeah, it's a good, like, in case of emergency, break glass sort of title. Like, that's sitting there if we ever need a backup plan.
I've never seen it.
Me either.
Surprising.
So I shouldn't assume. Yeah, I know. I hate it when but yeah.
Forget about Jaws 2. Let's cancel this recording. Watch Sharknado, and that's where I'm
gonna... Oh God, I brought this upon myself. It's fair.
No. I love Jaws and its sequels too much to do that. All right, but what are we talking about next time on Camp Kaiju? Give us a little sneak peek.
Next time we're talking about Space Amoeba. Honestly, I don't really know too much about this movie. It was directed by Eiichiro Honda, I believe. But it's not part of the Godzilla canon, or is it?
It is not a Godzilla film. It's a Toho film, so you could say it inhabits the same universe.
Okay. But I love the title. I love the... I'm kind of just reading the plot right now. I love the general plot synopsis. You have an alien amoeba, space probes, gigantic monsters of native life forms in the Pacific Ocean. I'm so excited for this movie. It sounds great.
It sounds great. I'm not going to say anything about it. Let you make your own opinion. But it is Eiichiro Honda. And yeah, does it stand the test of time? We'll see. After Space Amoeba, which is a great title, we have King Kong Lives, and friend of the pod and musician of the pod, Ben Cook Feltz. He does our music for Menia's Mailbox, that little interlude there. Ben joined us previously for Mothra and Mothra versus Godzilla years ago, so we're very excited to have him back on the show. He says King Kong Lives is like the movie that got him into kaiju films.
Whoa.
Super passionate fan there, despite all of its flaws, because I've never seen it, but I've heard mixed things about King Kong Lives. So we'll find out. I'm excited for that one, too.
Hmm. That's from the director of the 1976 King Kong, right?
I don't know if it's the same director, but I believe it's the same producer, which would be Dino De Laurentiis.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm excited for that one.
Yeah. I love a Dino De Laurentiis motion picture.
Yeah. All Dino all the time. Maybe that'll be one of our seasons coming up. That'd be fun.
Yeah. He did. I think he produced Orca that we did on the show. Yeah. He had a real real yang for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know what the expression is either. Yeah, yen. I don't think yen is totally right. He had a knack for it.
No, that is what I was trying to say. But you know, here we go.
Sorry, leading us astray as always.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change. Without passion and without logic. It lives to kill. a mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws. From the best-selling novel, Jaws. Rated PG. Maybe too intense for younger children.
Who could have imagined they were there? Who could have predicted they would attack? And now, who would survive? Your Honor, they're here.
No! Did you hear me?
Your Honor, they're hungry.
What's the matter with you?
Your Honor, they're unstoppable.
Stop that!
Hey, keep your hand out of the water.
What's wrong with the water?
The water is filled with carnivorous fish.
Your Honor, they call them the devilfish, because wherever they go, hell waits below.
They breed like flies. There'll be no way to stop them.
Suddenly, no one is safe. And everyone must be warned. The water is now a human death trap.
Two people have been killed up there, and more have been killed all along the river.
You've got to believe us.
These are the man-eaters who go beyond the bite of all other jaws. Sharks come alone. Piranha come in thousands. Crazed by the scent of blood, they live by the taste of flesh. With razor teeth, they can strip a man to the bone in a frozen instant of terror. Piranha. They're here. They're hungry. They'll eat you alive. Who can stop them?
So, what is your personal history with Jaws 2?
I had seen it before this most recent rewatch, but it was a long time ago. And I think it was the kind of thing where, like, I did see it all the way through once a long time ago, but, like, since then, it's, like, always on cable TV. So I see, like, bits and pieces here and there, like, a couple minutes, you know? And sometimes I'll turn it on like, TBS or whatever it is and be like, oh, this actually looks pretty good. And then other, you know, like a certain other like stretch of time in the movie, you might flip it on and be like, wow, this is terrible. I mean, maybe that's the movie in a nutshell, like the two extremes. But yeah, that's been my kind of like scattershot history with this movie. I had seen it a long time ago and then kind of just like fragments here and there.
Yeah, I'm with you. Scattershot's a good word to use with this film because like I had the VHS with my brother growing up, but I never watched it. I've seen Jaws more times than I can count. I know it by heart. But Jaws 2 and the sequels, but Jaws 2, I weirdly never watched. And it was only a few years ago I gave the whole series a concerted watch through. And, you know, I was like, okay, Jaws 2 is worthy of a discussion, I think. I don't know. Yeah, I think there's a lot to like and there's a lot to critique. So I'm with you. Let's unfurl the sails, shoot our cyanide tip bullets into the ocean and, you know, electrocute us a shark.
Yeah. Open wide and say, ah.
Yeah. I'm glad you caught that. Too. Not quite the same as smile, you son of a bitch.
Yeah. Yeah. It's trying to be the same, but it's not. It can't live up to it, of course.
I know.
Which defines Jaws 2 as a whole, perhaps.
Perhaps. Okay. let's get into the select crew and cast of this film. Now the director, forgive me, I've heard his name pronounced, but I know I'm gonna mispronounce it so hard. Gino Schwark. He is a French director of Polish Jewish ancestry. He and his family actually were in Paris when the Nazis invaded, and they fled. And that was in 1940 when he was a kid. He moved around a bit, but he ended up back in France in the late 40s. And he did not go to school for film. He kind of had an informal training. He left an advertising job in the 60s to work on Charade, the film, the Stanley Donen film in 1962, I think. So he just kind of kicked around the industry for the better part of a decade. He made in 1975 a movie called Bug, which, Matt, I think you have mentioned on this podcast.
I might have mentioned it, but I've never seen it before. I do like the more recent Bug by William Friedkin, but I've never seen the 1975 one.
Okay, maybe that's what you were talking about. But yeah, that just had my feelers up. So I was like, oh,
yeah,
making connections. Okay, cool. But Jaws 2 really was his breakout, and he was direct. I'll get to that bit later, but Jaws 2 was his breakout. Other well-known credits include 1980's Somewhere in Time, which looks really good to me. I'd like to see that time travel drama. Supergirl in 1984, and then related to Superman, he directed some episodes of Smallville in the 2000s, and he just died this past year at 87.
Yeah, rest in peace.
Yeah, long career, despite, you know, just kind of, well, I wouldn't say he fell into filmmaking. Like, he worked really hard. He had a long time interest in the photography and the cinematography. Honestly, I started typing up Gino Schwark notes, and I told myself, wait, this is not an episode about the director. It's an episode about Jaws 2. So I that was my truncated version.
Nice. I do the same thing. I fall into that trap too, where I'm like, I want to talk about everything, but we can't really do that. But yeah, Gino Schwark, I apologize if I'm not pronouncing that well, but I think he kind of started in TV. Like, I know he also directed some episodes of The Rockford Files and some other TV shows in the 1970s. And then, like you said, kind of came back to TV with Smallville and I think like Law and Order, maybe even like some other shows. So a big TV director as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Night Gallery is where he met production designer Joe Alves. And it was Alves who recommended Schwark for the job of Jaws 2. And Verna Fields, the Academy Award-winning editor on Jaws by Jaws 2, had been promoted to VP at Universal Studios, which, tremendous, terrific, love to see that. And she hired Schwark for the show, for the movie.
Yeah, I read that Alves and Verna Fields were going to co-direct this movie, but they weren't allowed to do that by the Directors Guild of America for a variety of kind of arbitrary reasons. So they got Schwark instead, which I think is kind of interesting.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, speaking of Joe Alves, I think we just kind of said what there's to say with him related to this film, but he was the production designer on Jaws 2. He had that same job with Spielberg's Jaws. And then he would actually go on to direct Jaws 3D. This episode is not about Jaws 3, but I think that movie is also worthy of discussion for good, bad, and campy elements.
Totally agree with that. Yes. I've seen Jaws 3D more often than I've seen Jaws 2 for whatever reason.
Same. Yeah. I don't know, but yeah. Okay. Music. John Williams came back for an original score, which surprised me. I thought it was just going to be a rehash of his Jaws score, but no, it's a new theme that he took pride in elaborating on and adding new elements to his composition. The film, must be said, it was produced by Richard D. Zanuck and David Brown, longtime Hollywood producing duo. They produced the first Jaws and gave Spielberg his start with The Sugarland Express. Those are the only two films that come to mind, but Zanuck and Brown, they are well-known Hollywood producers.
Zanuck, I think the son, maybe the grandson of Daryl Zanuck, one of the great super producers of all time.
That's right. Ah, it might be Zanuck, and I'm off the cuff here, but he produced Planet of the Apes as well. I think that was his first producing job, doing Planet of the Apes at Fox.
I think you're right. Yeah. That's quite a first credit. Like, what an auspicious beginning.
Seriously. So they're cool guys.
And I don't say that about a lot of producers. I don't know them, like, their histories in detail, but I feel like producers are often behind the scenes. Like, they're not as famous oftentimes as the other creatives on the team. But with Zanuck and Brown, I've known their names my whole life because I've loved Jaws my whole life.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you could say that Spielberg, you know, largely deserves credit for, like, inventing the modern day blockbuster by directing Jaws. But, you know, some of that credit goes to Zanuck and Brown as well for producing it.
Yeah. Screenplay is by Carl Gottlieb, who also penned the first Jaws script. And he's returning, not without some drama, but we'll get into that. Howard Sackler is co-writer of Jaws 2. He was a noted dramatist. He wrote a play called The Great White Hope, which is a callback to Congo.
Yep.
Ernie Hudson. And we talked about that Great White Hope connection there. So that's a lot of fun. He also, Howard Sackler, had an uncredited role doing rewrites on the first Jaws screenplay. And he actually co-wrote the Indianapolis monologue with Robert Shaw. So Howard Sackler, thank him and Shaw for that iconic monologue.
One of the best scenes in that movie.
Honestly. But now Howard Sackler is definitely credited with the screenplay on this movie.
Yeah, for sure. We have a lot of returning actors this time around in Jaws 2. We have Roy Scheider returning as Police Chief Martin Brody. Lorraine Gary playing his wife, Mrs. Ellen Brody. Murray Hamilton returning as Mayor Vaughn, one of the most detestable mayors in film history. Maybe a little bit more likable this time around, though. We also have Jeffrey Kramer returning as Deputy Hendricks, who's kind of a, you know, provides some comic relief in a supporting role. And last but not least, we have Joseph Mascolo, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, as Len Peterson. I feel like Len Peterson, the character, is kind of filling the Mayor Vaughn role this time around, where, like, he is despicable, he's weaselly, he's glad-handing, he doesn't believe there's any kind of shark threat, and of course, it swims up to bite him on the ass in Jaws 2. And then we also have a lot of teenagers who are playing, like, spoiled rich kids on the island. We won't really talk about them too much, though. The actors, anyway.
Right, right. The actors are... they're not the stars of this movie. A lot of the extras were locals who were hired. The teenagers, a lot of them were local high school kids who were hired to play these parts. Some of them went on to do other work in TV and film, but our main cast are exactly who you just mentioned. So a lot of returning players.
Yep.
With the production backstory, there's more to it than I thought, honestly. There are two main sources of references I want to just give credit to. The first is a 45-minute documentary called The Making of Jaws 2 by Laurent Bozzaro on the Jaws 2 DVD and Blu-ray. I watched that, so I'm coming in with that info. But there's also a book that I'm dying to get my hands on called Jaws 2, The Making of the Hollywood Sequel. And I'm crediting that, even though most of my research, to be honest, is coming from Wikipedia. But I know Wikipedia is sourcing all of its stuff from both this documentary and this book, The Making of Jaws 2. So just letting you know.
Nice.
All right. We have Zanuck and Brown. They decided to do a sequel to Jaws may have been the highest grossing movie of all time.
Yeah, at that point in 75, I think it might have been.
Yeah, so I think it makes all the sense in the world from a producing standpoint to make a follow-up film. However, this is big context. Sequels at this time were not a thing. They just weren't, not at this level. They were seen as cheap and gimmicky, tawdry maybe. They were nothing to be taken seriously. Steven Spielberg wanted no interest in it. Many of the casts, like Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss, they did not want anything to do with it. But Zanuck and Brown ultimately decided to do a sequel because they said if they didn't do it, somebody else would. So
they did a sequel. I also want to enlighten listeners on some other context. It's 1978 or 77 when all this pre-production is happening. At this time, in the wake of Jaws, we have so many spinoffs and ripoffs. Orca, Grizzly, Joe Dante's Piranha, Tentacles. Like, there's a whole subgenre all of a sudden of movies ripping off the Jaws formula. And it's interesting for me to think about Jaws 2 as prestige as it is, as like another clone in that tradition of Jaws ripoffs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And I would say some of those other ripoffs, like Orca, for example, are actually a little bit more original and interesting than Jaws 2, in my opinion. Like, you can definitely tell that this sequel is really trying to follow the template of Jaws, like, line by line, basically. It's really kind of course, there are differences, and we'll talk about those, but, like, yeah, it's... One could argue that, like, a lot of sequels, there's not really a reason for them to exist aside from just, like, studios making money. And that is absolutely 100% true in this case. Not to be too hard on it. Like, it's, you know, it's, but yeah, I mean, like, it's not really bringing anything new to the formula, you know?
I agree. Yeah. And I think, yeah, that I have critiques along those lines for sure. This is interesting. Howard Sackler pitched a prequel to Zanuck and Brown, and Universal head Sidney Sheinberg. His idea was actually a prequel where it would be a movie about the sinking of the Indianapolis, basically Quint's monologue in feature film length. And they liked it, but they decided that idea, that premise, wasn't in line with the Jaws world that they had established, which I get that. I think that makes sense. Again, if you're like wanting to make a sequel that you just want to make as close to the original as possible, what Howard Sackler is proposing, I believe, is way too rarefied. Like, that movie to me actually sounds like a Best Picture winner. You know, like a really prestige drama action movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah, which I would love to see. It's actually kind of a great concept for a movie, but definitely not Jaws 2. It went in a totally different direction.
I know.
You know, for better and worse, probably.
Yeah, yeah. You want to read any of this stuff?
Yeah, sure. So, like you just said, Sid Sheinberg and Universal rejected that idea. Sackler, around this time, did recommend director John D. Hancock to direct Jaws 2, and he was hired to do so. Hancock, however, had little film experience. He directed a movie called Bang the Drum Slowly. He also directed a cult movie, like a low-budget horror movie called Let's Scare Jessica to Death, which a lot of people like. I'm not a huge fan of that one, but, you know, generally he did kind of like low-budget atmospheric thrillers. And probably the high budget and the big, you know, the high pressure, the great expectations of Jaws 2 might have been a little bit too much for him. After 18 months of production, John D. Hancock was fired for basically that reason. The movie was becoming a little bit too dark and serious in tone. Universal execs wanted something a little bit lighter, more action-oriented, more entertaining. So that's one of the reasons that Hancock was fired. He also believes that he was fired because he was caught in the middle of an argument between Richard D. Zanuck and Sheinberg about having Lorraine Gary's character go out on the boat to save the teens and kind of becoming a little bit more of the hero of the film. Lorraine Gary happened to be Sheinberg's wife at the time, so certainly there was some conflict of interest there. Hancock did not want that to happen. He did not want that elevated sort of role for her character in this movie, and he thinks that he might have been partially fired for that reason as well.
Yeah. You know what's funny? In Jaws 4, Lorraine Gary goes out on the boat to save the day.
Yeah. And I like Jaws the Revenge, aka Jaws 4. Like, I think it's definitely not a great movie, but they're trying to do their own thing with it. And it's kind of cool to see her in that more leading role, which she does not have here.
Yes, I'll give that point to Jaws 4 over Jaws 2. And, you know, look, I think there's a total conflict of interest that I wish wasn't there. And it's also like nepotism and all that kind of stuff. But with that said, I think there is an argument to be made for elevating Ellen Brody to more than just the wife of Chief Brody.
Yeah.
Which I think could have been an interesting flavor to add to Jaws 2.
For sure. Yeah. In the finished film, she kind of just does pretty much the same thing that she did in the first Jaws movie, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yep.
But for the tone that Universal wanted for the film, they instead hired Jeannot Schwark after Hancock was fired. Carl Gottlieb was brought on to punch up the script, and production at that point continued. Three new mechanical sharks were built because the old ones had been left on the studio back lot to rot and rust. I read that they were just like in a basement in like in one of Universal's film studios. And it's like, Jaws was your highest grossing movie and you're just going to leave the mechanical shark there to rust and rot. Why would you do that?
My thought exactly, because my thought was, did no one have any foresight that they would make a sequel and want to use these again?
Right. And maybe we're just like fully stuck in our own period of movie making where like sequels are all over the place. But it's like, how was that not their first thought when Jaws made like $50 million or whatever, you know?
I think that is telling of the mindset. And it's so different than today. Today, you don't make a movie without considering the three or four sequels down the road, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
But clearly in 75, they did not want to even go near that idea.
Yeah. It also reminds me a little bit of Abira Horror of the Deep, which we talked about like a month and a half ago, where like, you know, Toho Studios would just like reuse any props and like suits that were lying around. Like, oh, there's the Mothra suit. Let's just bring Mothra into this movie. Like, that's, you know, why did Universal not do that in this case? It's an illuminating, a different approach, you know?
Totally. What I also wanted to say, oh, so I grew up in Orlando, and one of my favorite places in the world is Universal Studios Orlando, the theme park. But especially back in the 90s and early 2000s, it was very much still a functioning studio. Like, they would use the back lots of the theme park in various productions of TV, especially. But there was, as you snake through the lines to one ride or another, you would pass one of the mechanical sharks. It was from Jaws the Revenge, I think. But I grew up just like walking by one of the shark props.
Yeah.
Now I'm like, wow, that's special. But at the time I took it for granted. But yeah, it was just on the back lot, just sitting there.
Amazing. I wonder, I mean, I doubt they really have like similar things there now, right? I think they have a Jaws ride, or they used to, but I'm sure it's not the same. Yeah.
No, the Orlando park is totally remodeled with newer franchises, Harry Potter, yeah. Transformers, everything like that. But I think the Jaws ride still exists in Universal Tokyo, maybe? Mm-hmm. Don't quote me on that. It might still exist in Universal Hollywood. Listeners, let us know. But if you ever get a chance, it's a really fun ride.
Man, I would love to. Let's go to Tokyo. This is finally the thing that will motivate us to go there.
The Jaws ride.
Yeah. Not Toho Studios. It's the Jaws ride. That's a little bit sad.
Yeah.
Just kidding, of course.
Well, going back to our notes here, I do want to say that live shark footage in Jaws 2 was once again provided by shark documentarians Ron and Valerie Taylor, who did the same work for Spielberg in the first Jaws. And actually, I think that their live shark footage, now that I'm thinking about it, I think is more seamlessly cut into Jaws 2 than it was in the first Jaws.
Yeah, I think generally I would agree with that. I think there are some cases where like the underwater footage is not really intercut with like the shark attack scenes very convincingly, but it's hit or miss. That was one of the bad things that I was going to bring up in my breakdown later. But yeah, the footage itself is good. It's not always like edited or incorporated well into the surrounding scenes, I would say.
Yeah. No, I get that. And honestly, that's kind of a critique I have in the first Jaws. Like, it's really cool that it's there, and I love that element of the of live of real shark footage. But in the first Jaws, I feel like the mechanical shark is so monstrous that it just doesn't look like the same shark.
Yeah, yeah, that is true for sure. And yeah, I think you're right, because like there are also the scenes in Jaws 2 where like we see, you know, one of the three mechanical sharks that they had for this movie was like a full length 20 whatever foot shark that we like sometimes see, you know, going really fast under the water. And that's pretty convincing. Like when the movie cuts back and forth between those shots and like actual underwater footage, that stuff I think is really well done.
Yeah, yeah. There's the famous scene of the water skier, and there's a live shark of a great white like lunging to bite something, and that happens right before the jet skier, or sorry, the water skier is taken off her board. And that's one example where I think that works really well, that intercutting.
But yeah,
we'll get into it. Well, my next note here is that Schwark decided to show as much of the shark as possible. Right off the bat, his choice was, or his thought was, look, Spielberg did such a masterful job of hiding the shark and building suspense by what you can't see. I can't recreate that because everyone knows it's a shark movie. It's Jaws. Like, I can't, the secret's out, which I get.
Yeah, no, I was going to talk about that more, too. I do sort of understand that mindset, but at the same time, it's like, it goes against the rules of film suspense. Like, you should not show the threat in full view immediately and repeatedly in your movie. Like, I feel like even if audiences have seen the shark already in the first Jaws, like, to build up that suspense and, like, to prolong the terror for as long as possible, you know, I just don't think it works to show it so immediately and so fully. I think it does sap the movie of a lot of its suspense. And, you know, it reminds me of Hitchcock, who just, he like wrote the rules of cinematic suspense, basically. And it just like goes against everything he would teach you about how to make a movie, in particular a thriller, where like the joy of it for the audience and also like the thrill and the terror of it is like knowing something is going to strike, but not knowing when, not knowing what exactly it is. So like hypothetically, I understand where Schwark is coming from, but I just don't think it works. And I think he's incorrect in this case.
I'm not going to say it doesn't work. I think he makes a strong choice.
Yeah.
And he makes it work for what it is. But to your point, I don't think it would have not worked to have hid the shark and build the suspense. Because if I'm going into Spielberg's Jaws, I've probably already read the book. I've seen the poster. Like, I know it's a shark. Like, it's not like even in Spielberg's film, it's a great surprise what the creature is. Like, I know what it's gonna be. So yeah. I think Schwark also could have made that movie and still knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I understand where you're coming from. Cause like some of the really intense shark attacks earlier in the movie where we do see it just like lunge in full view out of the water, they're pretty effective. So I'll give you that for sure. They are effective.
Yeah. But you're right. I'm not buying the, it's not going to work because Spielberg already did it. Like, no, it could still work.
Yeah, pretty much everybody has seen a suspense movie before. Like we basically know what's going to happen, but it's still so fun to like wait for it, you know?
Yep, yep. Do you want to talk about Roy Scheider's experience on this movie?
Roy Scheider is back for Jaws 2, but he's not especially happy about it. He, of course, is so great in the first Jaws, but had no interest in doing the sequel at all. However, he had recently quit The Deer Hunter for creative differences. That was a somewhat chaotic shoot, and I think he didn't really get along with the director of that movie, Michael Cimino, very much. So he dropped out of The Deer Hunter, but he was still under a 3-picture contract with Universal. So, you know, Universal would allow him to break that contract if he appeared in Jaws 2, which he really, really did not want to do. As a result, he and Schwark butted heads a lot during the shooting of Jaws 2. Scheider would complain about Schwark ignoring principal actors and obsessing over technical details. Scheider thought that Schwark was just approaching the material all wrong and, like, you know, had strong thoughts about how he should do it instead. Zanuck and Brown had to call them into a meeting to settle their differences. And, you know, maybe not surprisingly, both these guys were pretty stubborn. I think they were pretty unapologetic and set in their ways, as a lot of larger-than-life film artists tend to be. A letter that Schwark wrote to Roy Scheider is kind of interesting. Schwark wrote in his letter to Roy Scheider, "Time and pressure are part of my reality, and priorities something I must deal with. You have been consulted and your suggestions made part of my scenes many times, whenever they did not contradict the overall concept of the picture. If you have to be offended, I deplore it, for no offense was meant. At this point in the game, your feelings or my feelings are immaterial and irrelevant. The picture is all that matters." I love that last line. It's great. I am the director. Let's just finish this thing basically the way I want to do it, you know? You know, I feel like that's what a director kind of has to do. Like, they have to butt heads with, like, the actors and the crew sometimes and be like, you know what? We're doing it my way. I'm the director. Let's finish this thing.
It makes me think about how Richard Stanley on the Island of Dr. Moreau absolutely could not do what Jeno Schwark did to Roy Scheider. Mm. And he let Brando and Val Kilmer walk all over him.
Totally. Yeah. I think, you know, it's a kind of unfortunate that so many directors seem to be such egotists and so, like, you know, they're like war generals, like leading their troops or whatever. But, like, yeah, they probably kind of have to be for, like, with this level of expectation and, like, power, you know. That's why I find film directors so fascinating.
Yeah. Despite all that, Roy Scheider did commit to doing his best in this movie. And I've read a lot of reviews that back that up, that say, you know, he's actually doing a pretty damn good job, despite not wanting to be there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. He's giving it his all.
Yeah. Richard Dreyfuss declined to return because Spielberg wasn't directing. Now, this is interesting and fascinating. Murray Hamilton, he plays Mayor Vaughn. He attempted to quit this movie. Like, he had his bags packed. He was headed out the door of the hotel. But David Brown caught wind of this and met Murray Hamilton in the lobby and said, "Murray, what's going on?" Murray said, "I don't care about my career. My wife is having a biopsy right now for a potential cancer. I'm leaving. I'm out." And David Brown said, "Okay, fine. I understand. What if we film all your scenes first and you could be out of here in 2 days?" And that's what they did. And the story ends up well. Murray Hamilton's wife did not have cancer. But that's just Murray Hamilton's story. And I have to say, watching this movie, before I knew that tidbit, I really want to know if you agree with, if you saw what I saw, but I'm watching Mayor Vaughn in this movie. And Murray Hamilton seems so, like, distraught. And, like, and me and Ellen were watching it and, like, is he going to throw up? Like, he looks so, like, sad and flummoxed. And yeah. Now I know why, because his mind was elsewhere on his wife. And he's like, "I'm just going to say my lines. I'm going to get out of here. And that'll be it."
Yeah, I kind of thought the same thing. I did know that backstory before I saw the movie, so that might have played a role in that a little bit. But yeah, the Mayor Vaughn character just seems kind of like tired in this movie, you know? Like, he doesn't have the strength to go on almost. And there's a really fascinating scene where Chief Brody has like a picture that he thinks shows a shark underwater, and he shows it to the whole town council, and like nobody except for Mayor Vaughn really believes him. They're all like, "Oh, whatever, Chief Brody, this is nothing at all." And it's kind of a reversal of the first film, because Mayor Vaughn is the only one who really kind of sticks up for him. And in a deleted scene from the movie, I read that the mayor is the only one who doesn't vote to fire Chief Brody from his police chief position. And this is just kind of goes back to Murray Hamilton's performance a little bit, because, like, it almost seems like he's disgusted with the people he works with. He's disgusted that, like, this is all happening all over again. But of course, there's that kind of, like, real life context that probably, like, adds some gravity to that, you know?
Yeah, so really interesting backstory there.
Yeah. So principal shooting took place in the later half of 1977. The team worked the last month without a single break to stay on schedule. I think it started in New England, but then they moved down to Florida, where the weather obviously was nicer, and they had, I think, deeper water to, like, have some of the, like, platforms for the cameras and some of the special effects. Schwark was given permission by his crew to to agree to this shooting schedule where they basically didn't have a break, as long as they got a big party every Saturday night, which seems like it's totally fitting for this movie. Like all the spoiled rich kids just like drinking and sailing and flirting the whole time. Like that's basically the crew of this movie is what I imagine.
Yeah.
So this kind of goes back to what I just said, but town scenes were filmed in Martha's Vineyard, and then the ocean scenes were filmed in Florida and the Gulf of Mexico. Production at sea was extremely challenging, as it was in the first movie. The Cable Junction Island, which is the island set that most of the movie's climax takes place at, was made entirely of fiberglass, and during a storm broke its anchors. The Coast Guard at one point called Jeannot Schwark to tell him that his island was floating to Cuba. Which, yep. Man, like the things you have to deal with as a movie director, how would you respond to that phone call in the middle of the night?
Crazy. So he's like, Roy, I don't need your crap right now. My island is floating towards Cuba. Just yeah. Learn your lines and do your job, please.
Yeah, we have an international incident here. I don't care about your feelings. Love that story, man. There was another case where hammerhead sharks circled the teen actors. So like late in the movie, all the teen actors are like in various sailboats and they're all kind of just adrift at sea. And there were actual hammerhead sharks that were surrounding the actors. All these teenage actors like tried to like notify the crew and be like, hey, help us. There are real sharks here. But, you know, these actors were supposed to be in distress. So the crew just thought they were in character and they didn't really know exactly what was going on at first, which is another hilarious story to me. Like, again, just like the ridiculous things that happen on a film set, you know?
Oh, beyond ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Luckily, the hammerhead sharks did not actually endanger the cast too much.
Yes, yes. They all survived.
Yeah. And they're oh, sorry.
No, well, yeah, just we had some deleted scenes, one you mentioned earlier, but there were some deleted scenes that were cut for as the studio wanted a more briskly paced film. So we cut some scenes with Ellen laughing at Brody's jealousy. Like there's a like the Len Peterson character, he's really flirting with Ellen, like in front of Martin this whole time. So some deleted scenes actually address that, including another scene where this is such a great scene. It's on the DVD Blu-ray, but Martin Brody writes up Len a parking ticket and it's purely out of spite. And Len's like, what? Really? You're going to do this to me? And Brody's like, yeah, yep. Yep, I need your license and registration, please.
Oh, that's great. I want to watch that scene. Man.
Yeah.
This is already a pretty long movie. It's almost 2 hours, so I understand why they had to cut some stuff out of it.
I'll you know, I don't mind peppering in just some critiques now. I would have preferred those scenes over some action scenes that I feel are filler. For example, there's a scene with diving swim class and great action, but ultimately that scene could be cut and you lose nothing because it doesn't add to like the story. So I don't know. That's me, my personal taste. Subtract some of those set pieces and add in some of that character development. That's really gonna give me something to chew on. No pun intended.
Nice. Yeah, I agree, but I would actually use other scenes as like stuff that I would want to be cut out of this movie, including everything with the kids in this movie. Like I don't care about them. Like they're like I read a funny Letterboxd review. There was a Letterboxd review where somebody was like, did you find Brody, Quint, and Hooper boring in the first Jaws and cared more about the spoiled rich kids on the island? Well, have I got a movie for you? Which is totally accurate. And like every time we see like the nerds who like can't get a date, or like, you know, the girl's cousin, she's trying to like set up her cousin with like Brody's son. There were several times while watching this movie where I asked myself out loud, why do I care? Why do I care about this or these characters? So I'm definitely like peppering in my critique here, obviously, but that's the stuff that I would want to be cut and like put in some of that character development stuff instead.
Yeah, you're not wrong there. I mean, this movie, Jaws 2, gets compared to a typical slasher film because you have all these forgettable teenage characters. And I agree. I like by the end of it, I'm like, yeah, they served their purpose, but this movie really could have been something special had we gotten to know these people instead of, oh, there she is screaming again. Great screamer. Like, that's a good, like, you're really good at that. But who are you? Like, what are your wants, your fears, your cares? Where do you come from? What's your background? Like, I want to know what you're struggling with and what this shark is a metaphor for you.
Yeah, totally. And maybe there are just too many characters. Like, if you focus on two of those young characters, then that could work, you know?
Totally. Like, I want to focus on the Brodies, first and foremost. And I want to focus on some girls, get some romance in there. But then, yeah, I mean, everyone else at the end of the day is just fodder. Just there to be killed.
Yeah. Just chum, to use that metaphor again.
Yeah, just chum in the water.
Yeah.
The film opened in June of 1978. It was, for a mere $30 million budget, the most expensive film Universal had ever made at that point, which is crazy to me. Yeah. But also, it ended up grossing over 200 million worldwide. So gangbusters. Retrospective reviews highlight the lead actors and the score by John Williams. It's also these days regarded as the best of the Jaws sequels, but that is a very low bar.
One could make the argument that it's not the worst of the Jaws sequels, but we'll return to that idea. Oh, sorry, not the best of the Jaws sequels is what I meant. I'm sorry about that. Yeah.
Totally. I think those, among those three sequels, it's like, what kind of flavor of ice cream do you want? Like, it's all it's all going to be delicious, but for different reasons, I guess.
Yeah. Delicious, but maybe not very satisfying in the end.
There are parts of Jaws 3 that I love. Dennis Quaid is in it, apparently on coke the whole time.
Yeah. Lou Gossett Jr. is in that as well. I love him in that movie.
He's very good in that.
Sorry to, I feel like I'm kind of diverting us again. But then in the fourth one, we have Michael Caine, like, and he didn't care about that movie at all, but he's still a pleasure to watch in that, you know? And the ridiculous plot of Jaws the Revenge. I love it. It's so absurd. It's great.
I know. Like, they're not unwatchable movies.
Right. Sorry, I just had to throw that in there because I'll talk more about that later. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Now, contemporary reviews were not so kind, mixed to negative. A couple that I want to shout out. Roger Ebert called it pure trash, which is awesome. Vincent Canby of the New York Times said some of the action sequences have been well staged, but they've been dropped into this film so indiscriminately that Jaws 2 never builds to a particular climax. It simply drones on and on like a television movie. Someone also made a mistake in showing us so much of the mechanical shark so early in the film. I only threw that in there because I think Vincent Canby is echoing we're echoing a lot of what Canby is saying in that like three sentence bite there. No pun intended.
So many shark puns. I love it.
But with all said and done, the legacy is actually long for this movie. It established the viability of sequels as a worthwhile venture in Hollywood. So you're welcome, pop culture. We talked about the tagline and the ride at Universal Studios. So, you know, Jaws 2.
Yeah. Yep. I think it was the highest grossing sequel of all time for 1 year. But then in 1979, Rocky 2 broke that record.
Oh, yes. All right. On that note, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media. And contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes. We have some comments to share with you all in Mina's mailbox. Just let me pull those up. These are in response to our special episode from Peter Lorre, the Poverty Row Picture Show. And we have superfan Don. The Peter Lorre appearances on the podcast are great, but putting them all together, awesome. Thank you, Don. We appreciate that. And then we have Mark on Spotify as well, says fun episode. Thank you, Mark. We also appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll get those comments over to Peter, wherever he is. I hear the screams have stopped, though.
Yeah, I haven't gone in there for several days, so who knows what's going on. There's an increasingly foul odor from his room, so I don't have high hopes, but at least he's quiet. I can finally get some sleep around here.
Nice. Good for you.
Yeah.
Take advantage. Yeah. It may not last long.
Right.
I also just want to shout out Jonathan, who reached out to me and let me know that he also found the Poverty Row Picture Show compilation episode really fun. And did point out an editing faux pas on my part, which I've now addressed. So your listening experience should be seamless. Folks, go back and listen to that episode. A lot of fun, as our listeners have stated.
Indeed.
All right. So coming up on the Poverty Row Picture Show is a 1943 movie called Ghosts on the Loose, starring Bela Lugosi and the Dead End Kids. Letterboxd likes to share maybe like the tagline of the film. And I love this tagline. It says, "You'll yell with glee when these happy-go-lucky hooligans invade the shivery domain of the Man of a Thousand Horrors. It's chilarious."
That's a good word.
So check out Ghosts on the Loose and join Peter Lorre.
I'm surprised we haven't really talked too much about the Abbott and Costello meet blah 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 fill in the blanks movies. I'm guessing we'll maybe bring some of them into the podcast at some point, but I'm curious about your thoughts.
Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein is one of the funniest movies ever made.
Yeah.
Arguably. Great. Like, that's a common no contest argument there. It's hilarious.
Yeah. Or chillarious. One might say.
One might say. The other ones I've seen, Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy, is so tired in its presentation. It's the last film they made as a duo. Mm. And they seem tired. The jokes are tired. The mummies are tired. Abbott and Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is fun. Boris Karloff plays Dr. Jekyll in that. And then there's Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man, which is also fun. But they're just, you know, they're worthwhile for the gags. But something about Meet Frankenstein is just, it's just like a complete movie in ways that it's more than just gags. So I that's my 2 minute review of those movies.
Yeah. I think the Frankenstein one is the only one that I saw like a long time ago when I was a kid. And maybe there's one where they meet the Wolfman also, right?
That's in that one.
Okay.
Yeah. So that plot is they run across Larry Talbot, played by Lon Chaney Jr. Mm-hmm. And of course he's like, "I gotta find a cure for my lycanthropy." And they're like, "Okay, buddy, every man turns into a wolf at the full moon." And he's like, "No, you don't understand. I'm really a wolf."
I vaguely remember that, I think, from a long time ago.
Yeah. So then they go find Dr. Frankenstein and Dracula shows up. And yeah, it's hilarity ensues. Chilarity ensues.
Yeah. Chilarity. Well, I'm sorry to lead us on that tangent, but I hope we bring one of those movies to the podcast at some point.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're great.
Welcome to the Poverty Row Studios on the other side of Hollywood, where the stars were dimmer and the red carpets dripped with blood. Together, we will watch the best of the worst. Movies known for their limited budgets, outlandish concepts, and questionable performances. But with enough haunted houses, zombies, ape men, and devil bats to keep you up at night, this is the Poverty Row Picture Show, and I dare you to sleep through these nightmares. Peter Lorre coming to you from inside the belly of my beloved yet admittedly bloodthirsty lilac plant. Yes, I have been swallowed by the monster, but fret not, as I have been consumed limb by broken limb, I managed to grab a hold of a sharp and pointed tooth. It broke off in my hand, and now, deep within the digestive tract of the lilac, I wield it as a sword and will soon be free of my captor's stomach. Ah! But I better act quick, lest I be liquefied by these acidic juices. Yes, I am free. Yes, take that, you infernal beast, back to the hell from whence you came. Now, on with the show. This week's movie is called Ghosts on the Loose. It is a tired 1943 outing with the East End Kids running amok in a haunted house with Bela Lugosi playing a gangster and Nazi agent out to get them. And while the synopsis promises chillerity, the film is anything but. Clocking in at 64 minutes, much of the film is comprised of antics fit for a first grader, but hardly worthy of any of the talents involved. Mr. Lugosi doesn't even show up until halfway through. Now, it is interesting to see the great Ava Gardner in an early role, but it is as thankless as anything else. You're much better off viewing the similar, but actually hilarious, Spooks Run Wild. All right. Well, next time we will cover another zombie picture called Revenge of the Zombies, starring John Carradine. And until then, I'll need to clean up this disgusting mess. Yuck! Perhaps Matthew might be so kind as to lend a hand, but fat chance knowing what care he has shown me until now, fighting for my life and an area. How are you, Peter? Do you need a hand, Peter? Perhaps a spade and shovel, Peter? Curse you, Matthew! Curse you, curse you!
A creature alive today has survived millions of years of evolution. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine that will attack and devour anything. One terrified you like nothing you have ever experienced when it captured your imagination and tapped your fear like no movie before it. Then, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, two continued the legend and spread the fear. And now, nature's most terrifying creature takes on an all-new dimension in an all-new adventure. And for the first time, the terror of Jaws will not stop at the edge of the screen. Jaws 3D. The third dimension is terror. Instinctively, man has always been drawn to the sea. Its beauty, its mystery, its secrets. But there is also a vague uncertainty, a sense of intrusion into an alien world where man is unwelcome and completely at the mercy of the most terrifying predator on Earth. Man's deepest fear has risen again. Jaws, the revenge. This time, it's personal.
Where are we at? Oh, themes. Let's talk about themes of this movie. What are the the thought-provoking questions this movie is begging us to answer?
Yeah. Are there themes in this movie? I mean, this isn't a theme per se, but I like what you said before, and I kind of read this in doing some research, just how Jaws 2 kind of does foreshadow slasher movies a little bit, where like the young kids are all like pleasure hedonism. They don't care about anything. Like Chief Brody's older son, whose name I forget right now.
Michael.
Yeah, that's it. You know, like defies his parents. He doesn't want to get a job, all this stuff. And then it's almost like all these kids are punished for their like just living in pleasure, you know, like the shark devours all of them, or not all of them, but like some of them, a couple of them. And it's similar to like the slash or the killer in slasher movies, like, you know, punishing promiscuous young people. Like, I don't know if there's really a deeper theme, but it's just kind of interesting that that looks forward to what would be a very popular genre in the next decade or so.
Yeah, there are two teens that we focus a lot on, actually. They are a romantic couple, Tina and Ed. Mm-hmm. And they are canoodling every chance they get. And we follow them a lot. But Ed ends up dying a really horrific death, I think. And I think that that sequence is really well done.
Yeah.
It's really frightening. And like that boy gets butchered to talk about slasher movies. And maybe coincidentally, maybe not, they're the real couple that's really, again, trying to make out and have sex whenever they can.
Yeah. Right. Again, I'm trying to think of a shark pun and it's not coming to me right away. But yeah, no, and like the actress who plays Tina is really good, because after Ed is killed, like, you believe in her trauma. She's like really messed up by what she witnesses. And I think you could say that too about the cousin who Michael's friend tries to set him up with. And, you know, she's a little bit, you know, like when Michael can't hang out, she's like, all right, I'll just make out with another boy. And then, like, you know, later on, some like really violent stuff happens, and it happens right in front of her. And she also like is totally messed up by it. And even though before I said that I don't care about any of the stuff that happens to the kids in this movie, and that's kind of true, you know, the actors are pretty good. And like, for some of them, you believe that they are traumatized by the carnage that they see right in front of them.
100%. I don't think those, especially those two actresses, and Schwark's direction, I suppose, like, those aren't thrown away. Like, those are really dug into portrayals of fear and trauma that I appreciate. I think that gives it a much needed gravity.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Martin Brody in this movie. I think thematically, I do enjoy seeing his character develop a little bit and wrestle with what he went through, the trauma he went through in Jaws 1. Mm. Like, there is a scene where he believes he sees a shark in the water on a crowded beach, and he does fire his gun into a crowd of people, and nobody's hurt or killed, but this act ultimately gets him fired. And it's like, this guy needs therapy. He has clearly been affected traumatically from his events in Jaws 1, and he does not know how to handle it. He probably shouldn't be police chief anymore. And I just found that a really interesting and needed character arc from the first film.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, like, the public humiliation that he goes through in that scene is pretty hard to watch. And, you know, Scheider plays it really well. And then, like, his interaction with his younger son, Sean, I think is his name. You know, Sean, his younger son, like, looks at all, like, the spent bullets on the sand that, like, his father is, like, just shot for no reason. That's a really touching moment. And I agree that that is, like, one of the deeper character elements in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about the good, the bad, and the campy here. What do you think?
I do think there are some very frightening, very intense scenes. Like, the part where it's like one of the first shark attacks. I'm pretty sure it's actually right after the water skier scene that you were talking about, where like this other person on the boat like tries to like fend off the shark and lights it on fire, and then her, like, she explodes. The whole boat blows up in this like fiery conflagration. Sorry, I rarely say that word a lot, but it's a really intense scene. It's very frightening. Like, honestly, up until that part of the movie, I was pretty bored. And then that happened, and I was like, oh shit, something's happening. Like, so that was intense. There are some other moments where, like, the shark just, like, it's kind of a jump scare, but, like, the shark, you know, jumps out of the water, and you don't totally expect it. Like, with the helicopter towards the end, for example. Yeah. And those are really effective scenes. And I guess that kind of contradicts what I said before that like maybe having just like brief glimpses would be more effective. But yeah, the movie's frightening and intense at times. It looks good, like some of it's shot very well. Roy Scheider is great. Yeah, I think I'll leave it at that for my good category.
Okay. Yeah, I'll echo those. I think the action set pieces are, I think they're done really well. I was compelled by them. I think the framing is done really well with a lot of these. And I think the shark is used well. That's what I said earlier. Like, yeah, you see a lot of the shark, but that's a strong choice that's done really well, I think. With the skier, the way that's shot, you see the fin behind her come up, and then the fin is racing parallel to her board. And it's like, yeah, I know the shark's there. I'm in suspense. And you're following the board under the water. There's a lot of POV shots of the shark, which I liked. The helicopter scene is so just over the top, but it's like that's an action movie set piece that I love because, but the way that you see the shark come up from the side of the pilot through the window. Mm-hmm. And I jumped a little bit. I was like, oh shit.
Yeah.
And the pilot doesn't stand a chance. And you're just like, man, this shark just ate a helicopter.
Yeah. That scene is great too. Well, you know, like the kids think they're about to be rescued. Like you can see the relief on their faces. They're like, oh, thank God we're not going to either starve to death on the sea or be eaten by a shark. And then the pilot lands in the water and like immediately it's like everything goes to hell. And you can see like on the kids' faces, they're like, all their elation just like crashes back down to earth, you know, like they're not going to get rescued. Like they're still screwed. They might not survive this. Like, you know, that's a pretty intense moment.
Yep. Yep. I do like the ending. The shark is electrocuted in a fiery conflagration. Very Green Mile, just just singed. I think it's awesome. But that's some campy stuff, so I'll save that too for campy. Quick shout out, there's a painting of all things that Schwark mentions in the making of documentary called The Raft of the Medusa. And it is a painting about a bunch of people hanging for dear life on a raft in the ocean. And he used this as an inspiration for shooting the kids. They all bring their own rafts together to float. So I just loved a little art history being thrown in there.
Yeah, cool.
For what it's worth.
I'm looking at that painting right now. I don't see a lot of formal similarities between that and Jaws 2, but it's, you know, it's cool that he brought that idea into it.
Yeah. There's a really cool painting from about like the 1700s of a shark attack in Havana Harbor. So if you Google shark attack in Havana Harbor painting, it's a really cool painting of a shark attack. You do that. I'm going to talk about the bad of Jaws 2. I'm like, the mayor doesn't believe him again. And this is why I wanted that deleted scene where we see Mayor Vaughn vote to keep Brody on staff. Because without that scene, I'm like, the mayor sucks even more in this movie. Why don't you believe him? That's my problem with a sequel, that it does its own thing. But it's also like, why are people hating on Brody? He deserves none of this.
Yeah.
It was hard for me to get over that because that didn't make any sense as a continuation of Jaws 1. I could feel this love triangle between Brody, Ellen, and Len Peterson, but the movie didn't go there because they deleted the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was left kind of just like, this is an interesting nugget that the film's giving me, but ultimately abandons. And I wish it had. I wish it had delved into some conflict between Brody and Ellen, because ultimately she ends up supporting him again. But there's so much that Brody does in this movie that threatens her livelihood because she's now like a real estate developer and she's embarrassed. I mean, there's reason for tension that I think could have heightened the dramatic chops of this movie. But ultimately, they don't do that with Ellen, and all that potential is just kind of discarded.
Well, first of all, let me say that I found this painting, Watson and the Shark, from 1778 by John Singleton Copley, and it's terrifying. It's a really beautiful painting. But yeah, it's like a bunch of people on this small boat, and this terrifying shark is about to just chomp into one of them, who's like submerged in the water. So thank you for pointing out this painting. It's incredible. I love it.
Yeah.
But yeah, bad stuff about Jaws 2. I agree with everything you said, and in particular, like, way too much time is wasted on the kids. I know I already talked about that a little bit, but it's like, you could focus on Brody and his wife and Len and that love triangle. You could focus on the Brody's kids a little bit more. Maybe if it's just like, you know, Michael and like one other teenager, that might have worked. You could focus on the shark, because honestly, for like the first hour and 15 minutes of the movie, we don't get a lot of it. It's like the last 45 minutes are very action heavy, but up until that, I think the movie's honestly kind of boring and tedious, because like we spend so much time with these kids sailing and flirting and trying to get laid, and like it's like, yeah, you know, we've seen this in any teen movie. I get it. I understand it. Like, so I really hate all that stuff. And I, you know, I think in, so first of all, Jeanneau Schwark, I'm sorry to speak ill of you, rest in peace, but like, I do think there are some TV movie aesthetics in Jaws 2. Like, I think, you know, so like a month and a half ago when we talked about Eberron, Horror of the Deep, I was like, I love Eiichiro Honda, don't love Jun Fukuda, and if you put movies by both of them side by side, you could see how to make a movie effectively and impactfully, and how to make a movie sloppily and sort of dully, you know? And I think the same is true here. And like, I'm, of course, if you compare Jaws 2 to the first Jaws, the second one's not going to be as good, of course. But like, Spielberg, you know, of course he knows how to craft a scene. He uses cinematography, editing, music, blocking, all the above to like make a scene as suspenseful as possible, or like emotional as possible, whatever he's trying to do. But like, Schwark, I don't think really tries to do that all that much in this movie. You mentioned that first scene with the scuba divers, and it's totally true of that scene. Like, it's such a good opportunity. Like, we could build suspense through music. We could like know that something is in the water before it suddenly jumps out. We could like have that atmosphere of dread built up from the start, but we don't. The movie doesn't even attempt that. Like, it's kind of just like a very sloppy opening. And I think the same is kind of true in that other scene with the scuba divers, which you talked about before, where there's some underwater footage, and the footage itself looks good, but it like clearly is not from the point of view of the shark. Like, it's kind of just like floating above, like among some seaweed or whatever. You know, I mean, like, it's not a very well-crafted scene, because ideally that scene should like be presented from the point of view of the shark. The suspense should be unbearable because we know that something terrible is about to happen. But that's not the case here in Jaws 2, because it's kind of just like a bunch of shots that make logical sense but are thrown together, yeah, sloppily, a little bit lazily. It just, throughout the entire movie, I was like, this is not a bad movie, but it could be so much better. If it was like told by a great visual storyteller, this could be so much more suspenseful and exciting. And I think every step of the way, Jeanneau Schwark misses the boat. That's another bad pun. But like, you know, just kind of, it should have so much more care and precision, and it just doesn't have that. So sorry again, Jeanneau Schwark. I just think this movie could be so much better than it is.
Word. Yeah, I agree with that, actually. Because I think this movie offers a lot of camp. I don't know if it's intentional. No, it's not intentional, but that's just the way it is with this movie. It might be its saving grace. Aside from me, I love the action set pieces, but some of them just completely veer into over the top, just extraordinary levels of action. Like when, after the water skier goes down, which was like a traditionally suspenseful chase scene, then the shark jumps into this boat. The poor woman, she's screaming her head off. She inadvertently dumps gasoline all over herself, shoots a flare gun, and the boat explodes to high heaven. And it's just like, oh my God. That escalated very quickly. And then it gives the shark a scar Then we have Scarface the Shark, which is just a touch that I love with this movie.
Yeah, I love that too. A great villainous shark.
Yeah. There was a there's a scene where all the teenagers are hanging out in a bar and they're drinking. And, you know, I know the drinking age was lower back then, but even the bartender looks like a teenager. And again, I was watching this movie with Ellen and she said, who's running this bar? Is it just a bar for teenagers? I was like, yeah, it looks like that, honestly. Everyone in this room is a teenager.
I would watch a spinoff that focuses on that bar for teenagers. That could be fun.
Yeah, so a lot of this movie actually made me laugh or chuckle. Yeah.
Same, yeah. I know you like the quip that Brody says at the very end, right? Before the shark is killed?
No, that's your favorite part.
Well, I do. Yeah, I do love that part. So the shark is like electrocuted at the end in a very improbable way. And, you know, in an effort to imitate the end of the first Jaws, when he says, smile, you son of a bitch. And this time around, Chief Brody is carrying like an electrical wire, waiting for the shark to come at him. And he's like, open wide and say, ah. And then the shark bites into the wire and gets electrocuted. And it's like, you know, if that huge great white shark is like barreling at you and you're holding an electrical wire, you're not going to have the time to make some stupid quip, you know? And that's in so many movies, of course, but it's like really ridiculous in this movie, especially because it's such a blatant ripoff of the first one. Yeah. So that is probably, I think, the campiest moment in the entire movie. But I do also love the moment where like Brody is like trying to get some driftwood basically out of the ocean, and like he's waiting for it to come to him and it doesn't, so then he has to go into the ocean and he like grabs the driftwood and like immediately a corpse that's somehow attached to the driftwood just like lunges up at him with this like shrill musical sting from John Williams. And again, that's a ripoff of the scene in the first Jaws where like the floating head comes out of the boat hole or whatever, the boat window. And it's just like, is the corpse holding on for dear life, like just to scare Chief Brody? What's going on here? It makes no sense. It's really ridiculous.
Yep.
But it made me laugh. So, you know, it's the epitome of campy, right?
Yeah. And the scene with the killer whale that's gotten bites taken out of it. And it's another moment where Brody knows what he's talking about. And there's a marine biologist doctor there. And she's just placating him like, okay, sure, you know things about sharks. And I'm like, why don't you listen to him? Nobody's listening to the man who literally fought and killed a shark in the last movie.
Yeah. It's probably a good thing that Brody's not in Jaws 3D because once again, nobody would listen to him. Even though this time around, all the kids in the city saw him electrocute a shark, they still would not listen to him in the hypothetical version that's playing in my head right now.
Yeah. And the movie ends, Jaws 2 ends real quick, but final breakdowns, take us away.
Yeah, so as always on Camp Kaiju, we give the film a rating. Number one, it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Our second rating, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. Our third rating, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it is not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time. I'll try to keep it brief. I think for me, this movie may be historically significant. And I guess you could say that it is by following up one of the biggest blockbusters of all time. It is fun at times, so I think it checks that off the list. But for me, it does not stand the test of time. I think long stretches of this are pretty boring and slow. There's a lot that I don't really care about. But of course, some good things that are pretty fun as well. And I, you know, with the sequels, with the other Jaws sequels, I was going to mention this very briefly. Jaws 3D is like sleazy and like ridiculous. And like, there's just so much about it that's so over the top. Jaws the Revenge, I love Michael Caine in that movie. Mario Van Peebles in a small role, I love him in that movie as well. And just the storyline is so ridiculous in that one too. Honestly, I think you can make the case that Jaws 3 and 4 are more entertaining than Jaws 2. Maybe not better than Jaws 2, but like this movie is pretty dull at times, and that's kind of unforgivable to me. So I'm going to give this our second lowest rating.
I think that's accurate because it's Rocky 2 again. Like it's too similar to the first one, where it's unable to carve its own identity, unlike 3 and 4, which, as bad as they are, they are their own movies. Yeah. They have their own tone that's completely different, and I appreciate that for the sequels. However, I think there's enough in Jaws 2 to be charmed by. You're going back to Amity. You're seeing Brody and the mayor. You get to see Roy Scheider actually develop his character a little bit more. And then I'm really taken by Shark's direction of the set pieces and the action moments. So I'm going to give it the second highest rating. There are antiquated moments, but I think this movie does stand the test of time, especially if you contextualize it as any of the other Jaws copies from the late 70s.
I love it. I do think it's kind of a repeat of our last episode, Congo, where, like, you know, I was a little more forgiving and you were rightfully so a little bit harder on it. I think our roles have kind of like flipped this time around.
That's, well, let's see what Space Amoeba does. It could bring us together or drive us further apart.
Yeah, we'll see. Can't wait.
All right. Well, thank you, Matt. Thank you all for listening. Please leave us a rating and review. Share this podcast with the world. Subscribe to our website. Follow us at camp_kaiju_podcast. Send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com. Links for all that and more in the show notes. Or if you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories. Please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more information. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with Mina's Mailbox Music by Ben Cook Phelps. Thank you, friends, and until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes.